Today on the 21st Show, we're going to the Krannert Art Museum in Central Illinois for an exhibit featuring the work of four black artists.
What the wall text when you visit the exhibition says is an ivory tower space that I know was not created with me in mind.
We have different American experiences. How are they connected? And how do we take this collective experience and create space for fresh empathy and action?
The exhibit is called Black on Black on Black on Black, and we'll be visiting for the hour. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is The 21st Show, a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Every year, the School of Art and Design at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign hosts an exhibition highlighting the work of its faculty. This year's program is called Black on Black on Black on Black, and it features the work of four faculty members.
Hi, I'm Nikita Thomas.
Hi, I am Blair Ebony Smith.
Hi, I'm Stacey Robinson.
All right, hi, I'm Patrick O'Hammy.
All four teach at the University of Illinois. Their exhibit spans several spaces within the Krannert Art Museum on the U of I campus in Champaign. There are paintings and drawings, larger installations, as well as sound work and video projections. The show opened in September and runs through December 10th. I got to visit last week and talk with the artists about their work, and so that will be the sole focus of our program today. I began by asking Nikita Thomas about the title of the show, Black on Black on Black on Black.
I think it is something that actually needed to happen. I think it might have been inspired organically by, especially by Blair Ebony Smith joining the tenure track as faculty and realizing that this is the first time that we have a good cohort of black faculty who are here at the School of Art and Design. I think it's also another moment where we were growing in diversity in regards to the fact that we don't just have two male faculty and a woman identifying faculty member, but also to female black women in this space.
Critical mass.
Absolutely. This is Blair here. I love what my colleague, you know, said about this needing to be something that happens. I'm new. I'm a fresh face. I don't come from an art school background. And so I think, you know, for me, it's just been a great journey that's been needed to also learn about my colleagues, the experience of black faculty in School of Art and Design and the arts, and to think about like how that translates across the college, across the university as well.
Yeah. I was just going to mention that in the history of the School of Art and Design, there have only been eight black faculty, right? So it's, and to think about that, like all that history, right? Five of us are here right now out of that eight. So it's like, yay, but it's like, dang, you know? So the name represents the four of us, black on black on black on black, celebrating our black faculty.
Hi, Patrick here. This is an important time talking about history to acknowledge Indolyn Taylor Outlaw, who in her role as Dean Fellow, she really brought and raised the awareness and the connectivity of black research in the arts and started a huge conversation that was needed. And this was a really smart and I believe important pickup of that momentum by the college and by the Krannert Art Museum and by the School of Art and Design to recognize this moment and carve out a space so we can continue that celebration through our work and make space for the community to see themselves reflected.
Well, maybe we can start by talking. We're standing in front of this almost room-size piece here. I'm looking at black t-shirts hanging from the ceiling. Some of them say protect black space. There are milk crates on the ground. I know it can always be tricky for artists to talk about their work, but what are we looking at?
This is Nikita here. We're looking at the manifestation of black space protocols on exhibition. And this space is really dedicated to me developing the most dynamic and nuanced definitions of what a black space is. And it really starts at this point of sort of defining Black space as something that's not inherent to space. Space is not inherently Black per se, but you can definitely feel when you stepped into a Black space how it smells, how it looks, how it functions and behaves. And it takes as a starting point that Black space is a combination of settings and built environments and things of that sort that points back to the Black cultural experience. And so what we're looking at is one sort of iteration of my Black space and sort of how I've come to know the ways that I behave with space and use mundane products such as milk crates and also graphic tees to sort of make something out of nothing and make the spaces that I feel fortify my life and my existence and allow me to dream out new possibilities of those configurations of a supportive Black space.
Can I ask about your process? Does the idea come first? Do the physical objects come first? Does the room come first? How does that work for you?
That is a really good question. I think my work exists. I never really situate my work in a art museum sort of context. I'm very much so into popular culture and to situating my work into the now. So playing around with things that are already in existence and finding space that doesn't necessarily feel like it's an opportunity for art intervention or a design intervention is what's most interesting to me because it sort of jolts people out of their everyday experiences and get them to critically look at and sort of engage with a space differently. So for me, the real starting place is kind of going within and really sitting with what it is that I need in a present moment or a particular phase in my life. And for me, what I needed is a space that did not feel disorienting, especially being in what the wall text when you visit the exhibition says is an ivory tower space that I know was not created with me in mind. And so I'm sitting with the fact that, and thinking about the fact that, you know, being sort of this other body in this space is something that is not a phenomenon that needs to be glossed over, but rather having moments to really grapple with that and think about how can I build something from that and prototype with materials that I already know that come from my upbringing and my childhood too, and that become just as important as the modeling clays or other sorts of techniques that we learn in art and design school as a way to sort of build and process and prototype and iterate. So for me, this is the starting place is definitely what I need right now, and the rest of the products are a part of what comes from my own background and experience and feels very familiar to me, but can be used as sort of like the products to help you dream out any type of world that you need to build for yourself.
I wonder if we can drill down and if anybody else wants to respond to that idea of making a space. It's the campus, the ivory tower, right, is not a space that was made with Black people in mind, certainly this campus anyway, in 1867. Mm-hmm. And making a space in that, within that, does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, maybe how I come to it or, you know, maybe the language is a little bit differently. But I come to this work by being with my homegirls and a part of a collective called Saving Our Lives, Hear Our Truths. And in that work, I'm a scholar, I'm a DJ. You know, a lot of people that do that work have PhDs, are scholars, are artists, professionals of all, you know, sorts of things. And so we, you know, we think about what it means to be Black girls and women in the ivory tower, in our schools, in our neighborhoods. And so, I don't know, I think for me, it's a conversation about, right, and I think what Nikita is able to connect through her installation. Like, it's the ivory tower, it's the projects in Chicago, like, it's all of these spaces where Black people are often surveilled or aren't welcome or, I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of violence and death comes out of that too, like, that's a part of it. So, I don't know, I think for me, it helps me to, like, think about it within this space, but, you know, also extend, like, yeah, it's everywhere, like, it permeates everywhere.
Can I add one
to that?
Sure.
What Blair, I think, said just now is really important because, you know, I don't necessarily like to situate myself in contrast to anything. I just like to be. But it's something about what you said, that your work really starts from a place of being with your homegirls. And I think that being in a disorienting space, such as an ivory tower space, is one of the first times that I have to really grapple with the fact that I feel a sort of sense of otherness or even disoriented in the first place. So, like, really taking the moment to say that the work is not rooted there, but it actually makes me have to look at, like, why do I feel so different today when otherwise I would feel just fine and feel very supported and sort of like there's no limits to whatever capacities I could have in a day, right? So I think that that's important.
And I will say too, you know, my colleagues, and you know, I think Nikita too, especially how vocal you are about how this connects right to your experiences coming from an art school, because I am new, you know, it's just helpful. I mean, because I think I am, you know, I come to it from my homegirls. I think I'm able to like block some of that stuff out because a part of my academic experience is with Soul Hot. So like, this is new for me, having to do these conversations about my art. I'm used to doing that with my homegirls. But, you know, I'm able to hear from y'all or what y'all experiencing in this space. And be able to move and navigate, too. So.
Well, I don't know if we can move to another room, maybe, and talk about someone else's work. Yeah. So tell me where to start. Where do you want to start?
Let's go into the sound room.
I like it.
There is a soundscape on view, but I turn it down for conversation purposes.
Sure.
So, this is Blair here again. We are in the Soundhouse listening room of my installation, which is titled Turn Me On, Would You Come On Home? And it is inspired by a Roy Ayers song on his album Fever in 1979 called Love Will Bring Us Back Together. And that was a song that I found on my father's, my deceased father's mix CDs. And that's like how this started. I'm a sound artist. I work a lot with sound. And I DJ, I sample. And I wanted to sit with how I even come to that. And it started with my father's CDs, the stereo system, the things that I listened to growing up. And so I'm listening to see what themes are coming up for me. One of those things is love. So you'll see a lot of reference to love. But I'm also making sense of how like I come to it, but also how Black people come to it, you know, giving myself permission to be like, hey, you know, my family is also a part of this conversation. And it's also a way to get to know myself, to remember collectively. So what you'll see is a mix of sound, collage, me playing around with my family photos and archives on different types of material and texture and surface. And it's actual stereo system, which is inspired by stereo systems that I found in my family archives that I grew up with. As well, there are records from my father's collection and my own collection over the years that I've also collected to remember him and think about how I come to education, to sound. You know, a part of this soundscape, my aunt is like, you know, remembering with me and telling me, you know, how she saw my father as a teacher, you know, right? And I'm an art education, I'm teaching art to teachers, right? So like to be able to remember and reflect with my family in those ways, it's super important, super critical. And I also hope people, you know, from experiencing it are able to like, you know, remember folks that they want to remember, be vulnerable, anybody really, truly. But also, right, you know, this is really much rooted in how Black people love, remember, and think about space and time, make space and time.
Yeah. And maybe I can just say we're in this room within a room, right? It's, yes. It's got pine 2x4s. You can smell the pine.
Yes.
Plexiglass,
yes.
A lamp, a little table, this stereo yes. system. Is that the stereo system from your youth?
It is not. Okay. So it started with that stereo system. But, you know, thinking about preservation, care, and all of those things.
Yeah.
And to be honest, all of the resources that they put towards this faculty show. I'm like, how can I, you know, take the objects that I'm sitting with in my own personal home and build on it within this space. So some of this material is actually from the museum, the receiver, the Black speakers are. The speakers at the bottom, they're not active, but those are speakers I brought in from home. This is also something I brought in from home. It's not my father's though. It's something that I've collected along the way. I didn't want to bring those things per se in because they're so sacred
yeah,
to
sure.
me. But it was a way for me to like rebuild, to make an altar, to remember my dad, my family, and myself, ultimately.
What do you hope people when they come into this room? What do you want them to leave with? There's a mirror. They can look inside a little bit.
Yeah, see yourself. Man, I think, you know, I think I want folks to sit with, you know, how Black people make space in conversation with my colleague, Nikita, especially, how we sit with music in each other to remember, like how that affects how we remember. So maybe someone comes in and they, you know, maybe it's not a song that they remember, but they could be like, hey, you know, for instance, you know, I had someone be like, yeah, you know, I just recently had a conversation with my grandfather in this about this Royal Ayers record. So, you know, I want people to remember people that they want to remember. I think that's the gist, to be honest, like in that the vulnerability, that sharing, especially Black girls and women. Can see themselves too in it. And also, like, I have my cousin, she's here, like, to be able to share that with my family, for her to come in here and be like, yeah, that's my grandmother. Like, her grandmother is on that recording, my aunt, you know, so that's super special, so.
And there's a playlist that goes with this. Yes. We need to
of
take a break.
I don't have any takeaways, but I'll get you an email with the actual,
Spotify.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we need to take a break on the show. What song should we go out with?
Wow, let's go out with Roy Ayers. Love will bring us back together.
This is the 21st show. More to come from our visit at the Krannert Art Museum and the exhibit Black on Black on Black on Black in just a moment. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're continuing our exploration of the exhibit Black on Black on Black on Black, open now through December 10th at the Krannert Art Museum in Champaign. It features the work of four Black faculty artists at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Before the break, we heard about the work of Nikita Thomas and Blair Ebony Smith, and later we'll hear from Patrick Earl Hammy. But up next is Stacy Robinson, a graphic artist and DJ. And when you enter the room where his work is on exhibit, the first thing you're likely to notice is a floor-to-ceiling video projection, currently showing a DJ set on which he collaborated earlier this year. What are we hearing?
We are hearing, as soon as you're walking in, you're hearing a DJ set spun by DJ Kamau Grantham and myself, Stacy Blackstar Robinson. This is a virtual DJ set that we spun on Twitch and recorded on February 19th of this year. That was part of Carnegie Hall's Afrofuturism Festival. It was a 24-hour worldwide DJ cipher. So there were DJs from around the world spinning an hour-long set on Twitch. And there was, so on the 18th, there were 12 DJs, and then on the 19th, there were 12 DJs. And this is the recording of that set. And that is part, this DJ set is part of the installation in this room. So this room, there are four different things happening in this room. Just opposite of the projected DJ set is the main part of the exhibition, which we, Kamau and I call Black Audacious Freedom Dreams. And it is a collection of 10 of our most recent works that look at Black dreams and the audacity of Black dreams. And that title, Black Audacious Freedom Dreams, comes from Robin D.G. Kelly's book, Freedom Dreams, but also from Bettina L. Love's book, We Want to Do More to Survive. And in that book, she talks about how many times Black people have been punished and are punished for audaciously dreaming for more. And sometimes that more is equity or equality or just pay or justice. Right, so Black people are punished many times for wanting those things. But in the time of the COVID era, I think that the way that we exit into our better tomorrows is by today audaciously dreaming. So when we think about that, 100 years ago, if we can compare this time to then, 100 years ago, we were exiting the First World War, the Spanish flu. Women's right to vote happened in that time, and many other things happened. But we exited that horrific time in many ways into what we would call the Roaring 20s, right? However, in that Roaring 20s, opened up America for vast possibilities. However, by the end of the 1920s, we would be entering into the Great Depression. So if we can think about that time speculatively, like I'd like to think about, we may be witnessing the end of capitalism as we know it because of the other types of currency that we are utilizing now, which is very, very interesting to me. So for me, audaciously dreaming is the way that we can think about what the grand possibilities of our tomorrow might be. So Kamau and I created these 10 works. And
maybe we should say these are panels, what, 7 feet tall?
Sure, these are seven, well, there are 10 panels. There are 7 feet, 10 banners, 7 feet. They're viewed from the front and back. We just invite our audience to take in the spectacle, and it's very open to interpretation, but I'm a very deliberate artist, so there are very clear meanings for me in particular works. However,
so this is not the classic English, what happens at the end of the story. You have an idea you want to convey.
Oh, I definitely have an idea, but at the same time, what I encourage my audience to do is to imagine and create and to think through what they see, right? And many people, they bring a narrative to it, and some people, they get it. They understand it. And some are saying, well, I'm seeing this, and this speaks this to me too. And I think that's wonderful, because if I give you exactly what the meaning is, it doesn't, I think our audience will shut down and not think of more. And I think that's dangerous as we're talking about building tomorrows. Kamau is a more of an experimental artist. He'll make work and say, you know what? It doesn't, you know, I don't know what this means, or it doesn't mean anything. I just made it because I like it, right? And I love working with Kamau because of that. I think we balance each other out in some very interesting ways. Some ways that are not always comfortable for me, because I am so deliberate and so detailed at times, and Kamau is very minimal. And he's much more go with the flow. And I'm like, I think we balance each other out, and I'm finding my comfortability and just kind of letting things go and follow that lead that he kind of sets up many times.
And maybe I can just, if I can, sure, interrupt to say, like, what some of the things we're seeing, which are, you know, a face turned upside down, the head is cross-sectioned, there's water flowing up. There's water in a lot of these images.
Yes.
There's, I don't know if that's a mermaid imagery, a man doing yoga. I guess people can do what they want with that word, a crown.
Man doing yoga. Yes, that's exactly what I did. Yeah.
I mean, it's really stunning. I don't know if I've never taken an art history class, but is surrealist a word you would use?
Yeah, nope, definitely. The genres of art that this would be categorized under would be Afrofuturism and Afro-surrealism. Absolutely right. And
I interrupt you. You were talking about your process.
Yeah, so the process. So sometimes Kamau starts a piece and he'll give it to me and say, you know, I don't know what else to do with this, but this needs something. And sometimes I will see a narrative in that. And I was like, oh, this is what I see. And we will go back and forth. I'll send him something, and then he'll respond to that maybe, or And sometimes I'm making work and I'll send it to him for him to complete. Sometimes he makes work totally him, and sometimes I make work totally me. Another thing that you will see in the projection, so the video projection, within this video projection is not just Kamau and I spinning on the turntables, which the DJ set takes place in my apartment. But I'm also
seeing a drawing taking place.
But now you're seeing a drawing taking place, and this drawing is a time-lapse video from a piece that I created for Toshi Regan when she came to our campus, and her opera, Parable, Parable of the Sower. But this drawing was created for that event, and it represents the community that we want to see, that we always think about when we say, somebody ought to do something about this thing, or somebody, I wish somebody would, you know, consider the homeless or whatever. Well, in thinking about Parable of the Sower, the book by Octavia Butler, that very seminal text, and thinking about what community means to me coming out of the COVID era, in the COVID era and coming out of the COVID era, this drawing represents that. So we're watching a video of many abstracted faces and figures that are intertwining with each other, and they're progressing in a direction. And that direction is that tomorrow that we will not see, right? So in thinking, like Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King thought, where he said, I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land, but I may not get there with you. We're thinking about building a community for a people we do not know today, right? So we're building this community, this better or this equitable tomorrow, just like this work that we're looking at, these 10 banners that are hanging. They represent the audacity of our dreams for a generation we will not ever meet.
Or
right.
Millions of generations.
Or millions.
Right?
Well, yeah. You know what? And I like that as a possibility, right? And I think we need to be socially responsible in thinking about that. So with my work, I like to draw the prompt or create the prompt that I want people to think about. And then also to add to the commentary. What is not there? What am I not saying? What is missing from the commentary? Like I said, if I give you everything, then I believe that the audience will shut down and not think. And I want the audience to think. This is our tomorrows that we're building, right? So, so that's what we're looking at. And within this DJ set, there are several breaks where you will look at slideshows and animations of videos and drawings that, in my opinion, show what I think this future might sound like. And I'm thinking about that as a practice as well. What does my work sound like? Or in this particular case, what does Black Mao, our artwork, what does our work sound like? Black Mao being myself, Stacy, Black Star Robinson, and Kamau, DJ Kamau Mao Grantham, as a collaborative duo. What does our work sound like? And to me, partially it sounds like the past. It sounds like those hip hop samples that were heavy influences as I was going to the record store. I was listening to hip hop on my Walkman, and I would take it to the record store and I'd take it to the owner. I'd put my headphones on the owner's ears, and he'd be like, hey, what is this sound? Where is this sound coming from? And they'd be like, I don't know, kid. You know, I was like 18, 19 going to the record store. Imagine I'm trying to collect records. I was crate digging, yeah. Right? And I didn't, I don't know. I'm sure crate digging was a thing at that time, but I didn't know of it as crate digging at the time. But it became that love of would become an archival practice and a heavy, heavy part of my research. So in part, that is what my artwork sounds like, right? And with Kamau, he's spinning a very, very different DJ set that is Afrobeat world music. I'm spinning hip hop and original samples, and I think there's some jazz in there as well. And together, I think we make a very cohesive yet odd mix of a sonic experience. That is that part. So we talked about two parts of this exhibition.
And if just these, looking at these images, it is sort of a visual manifestation of a DJ with a really good crate, right?
So if I could steal a quote from a very good friend of mine, my best friend and collaborator, John Jennings, he would call this CJing, like DJing, right? So like a DJ digs through crates and you know, to find perfect sounds, and like we dig through other visual media, right? Sometimes it's photos, and we're collaging from various sources. Sometimes we're like certain paper textures and things like that, glitches in this case too. We're CJing, you know? We're digging through this and we're collaging this together to create this perfect amalgam of visual samples, right? So
part one, so DJ set, part two, visual panel.
Part two, yeah. Sure. The third part of this this exhibition, Black Audacious Freedom Dreams, is the book collection that we borrowed from the Ricker Library. Is that where we have the Ricker Library? And it's a collection of books that some from our colleagues from other universities, friends from other universities, all dealing with Black speculative imaginings and music, comics, graphic novels, and in the various ways that we think about Black futures and Black imagination and the Black fantastic, right? And just exploring all of that. These books are meant to be read, so you are meant to, the audience is meant to come in to sit down.
Please touch.
Or please touch. Lay down, you know, lay down and read the book. Don't take the book, right? Don't take the book from the space, or we would have to replace that. These books are not ours. But the Ricker Library has been very generous in letting us hold on to these for the duration of this exhibition, which is up until December 10th. The fourth part of this work is this space that we have here where my colleagues are sitting, they're working, they're on their phones, they're on their computers, they're hanging out, feet are up and crossed, they're chilling, they're relaxing. This is what you're supposed to do in this space. So if you want to take a break, just enjoy a moment of peace, this is what this space is about. Mm-hmm. However, just like when Nikita was talking and was talking about space and commandeering space for politicking and manifesting and these other ways of thinking, that's what this is meant for this space as well. So one of the interesting questions came up during our during the opening. We had a panel discussion, and one of the questions came up from a student, something along the lines of how can Black people have space, right? And we're talking about young Black people having space. And that's exactly what this space is about. And sometimes we don't necessarily have to ask for space, we just take space, right? We take what we need. And I think in this particular case, you don't have to take it, we're giving it to you. Like we're saying, hey, this is a museum. Like we know this spot, this space is not meant for gathering and hanging out and arguing about the latest politics or fashion or the direction of our future or whatever. But here, at this very moment, is a temporary utopian space, right? It might not last, it might not be that after December 10th. Right here, right now, this is your space to do whatever you want to do. So in your wildest imagination, what type of collaboration can you create or come up with or begin to think through in this space with all of this opulent art that celebrates Black beauty and the fantastic? I think it's also important to say that when Black people create space, sometimes other or non-Black people think that the space is not for them. In this particular, sometimes that is the case, right? Sometimes that is the case. In this particular case, this space is made for all of us. So I've been having amazing conversations with faculty who want to come in and collaborate. That's what this space is about, right? So really looking forward to seeing the type of collaborations that will come forth when people take advantage of this space that's made for them.
Well, all right. Star Child, citizens of the universe, recording angels. We have returned to claim the pyramid.
More to come in just a moment from the exhibit Black on Black on Black on Black. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
Light year groove. Well, all right. You hear the noise? There ain't nobody but me, boy. Get down.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we've come to the final conversation in our show on the exhibit Black on Black on Black on Black at the Krannert Art Museum in Champaign, Illinois. It runs through December 10th and features the work of four black faculty artists at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Earlier in the show, we heard from Nikita Thomas and Blair Ebony Smith, then Stacey Robinson, and now Patrick Earl Hammy. His work spans all four walls of a large room, drawings and paintings, including some on the wall itself. Some are bright, colorful images of what you might call black joy, including drawings of the TV program Soul Train. Others are more abstract, and frankly, a little disturbing, looking like giant Rorschach tests. As I was entering the exhibit space for the first time, Patrick offered me a moment to take it in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
The beauty contrasts, and then you read the words, you realize what it's conveying there. So, where do you want to start?
What do you want to know? I mean, there's a lot. There's definitely a lot of threads running through here. This is the culmination for me of about 2 years worth of work. There's two big ideas that are navigating in here that are coming together in a third. And this is, for some of these works, the third iteration. So this project, this leg of the work is titled I Am the Night. And as I mentioned earlier, being into pool and tennis, on top of that, I'm a huge nerd. And so, a previous body of work that was an iteration of this was titled I Am Legend. And that was inspired by the famous protest posters, I Am and I Am a Man, declaring black personhood, kind of mashed with the Robert Matheson's book, I Am Legend, all about, you know, vampires and how the main character, who's the only, you know, normalish human left, toils violently to destroy what he perceives as monsters, but they've become the new normal, right? And so when I entered into this conversation, I'm thinking about these related and correlated American histories that weave in and out of each other, particularly black and white experiences in America, as a type of mutual haunting that Robert Matheson's book and his character Robert Neville, really Richard Matheson's book, sorry, and Robert Neville, the character's effort to fix and return the world back to what it was, resonates with me with what I was seeing happening in the media today. So this body of work grew out of me sitting alone at home during the pandemic, generally afraid, as many people were, afraid to go outside, afraid to breathe on people, touch doorknobs, not knowing how, if I could get the COVID. And so on top of that, you know, I was looking for moments of joy. I was trying to find spaces to find respite. And for some, it was like, for me, it was Ted Lasso. You know, Ted Lasso brought a lot of light into the house, but I also found myself returning to something I enjoyed as a child, which was Soul Train. I remember tuning in and being transported to the glitz and suede of the black imagination. It was magical, it was spectacle and spectacular.
Soul Train. Television's longest-running syndicated music program and the hippest trip in America with guest stars.
There was fashion, there was dancing, and there was music, and it was, you know, it was very earnest. Like, celebrities would sit on stage with with the dancers and staff and just have honest conversations without the A&Rs and the managers and Hollywood. It was just them, just talking.
Next question.
Yes, my name is Jasmine January, and I'd like to know, how do you guys like doing Soul Train?
We love it. What other way?
Are you kidding?
I love Don.
You do?
We've had it going for a while now.
Okay, all right.
So that was a really nice thing to return to with adult eyes and see it differently, you know, seeing some of the cracks, if you will, of like the tape on the floor and the lights, and like it's a set, but it still is magical. Didn't lose that patina. So that was half of my experience, you know, at that time. But then month after month, we saw continuing examples of Black Death. You know, with Armand Aubrey, George Floyd, it just was on and on. Every single month there was something new. And there was very public examples, but then many people were navigating very personal examples, things that were close to home, things in our community, as well as things literally in the home with loved ones passing away from violence or from the virus, right? And so so after seeing, you know, George Floyd's video so many times, which for me I feel is a modern day lynching, I had to ask myself, where was my first time encountering this as an idea? And for me, virtually, it was in the movie Candyman from 1992, mm-hmm. Which they've remade recently. A lot of people have seen it. Where
set in a Chicago housing project. Yeah.
In Cabrini Green, absolutely, absolutely. Which in itself doesn't exist as it was anymore through gentrification. In the movie, the titular character is an artist, a portraitist, a black man, free man, who is hired to paint a white woman's portrait. And they fall in love. And the father is not very happy about this and hires a mob to kill him. And as an adult now, looking back at this with adult eyes again, I'm implicated. You know, I'm an artist, I'm a portraitist, I'm a black man, and I'm married to a white woman. And, you know, I saw myself reflected in that history and the call for vengeance and frustration and anger. And so that led me into researching more about American lynchings. And I found myself, you know, after reading the many, you know, writings on the back of postcards, through archives, that how many of the white people who perpetuated this Black Death were speculating safe and secure futures for their children. They were trying to achieve a world they thought they wanted through this violence. They were toiling like Robert Neville. And so that began this journey of how to think through these histories. You know, vigilante mobs have roots back to night watches and slave patrols, which were organized groups to catch runaway slaves. Those legacies continue through vigilante justice, and some of those organized groups that were already good at catching people were organized into some of the first police municipalities. And so many of the structures and institutions we have to police ourselves, to enact laws, are rooted in some of these histories. And it's hard to change that ship, especially if you don't talk about it. I found correlation in Soul Train, which is a site of joy and safety and celebration and excellence, but is also rooted in these histories. In 1971, it came out of the violence of the 60s, a lot of death of progressive leaders. Some might access it just as a form of entertainment. But like it does it a disservice to see how people dance and move and act and be and celebrate and sing without acknowledging the full black experience. And that was a black experience still in the 60s, that this was necessary as a reaction, right? Don Cornelius himself is, and you know, additionally is beautifully complicated, was a police officer before he started Soul Train.
Did not know that.
So these histories are complicated and they're complex, and we tease them out and we treat them very differently, but these American histories, these American stories are interrelated. The reason I titled this leg of the work, I Am the Night, which I promised I'd get back to, is similarly in a nerd type way, it's kind of inspired in part by the really popular 1992 animated series, Batman, where one of his very prominent taglines is, I am vengeance, I am the night, I am Batman. Now, we remember I am Batman, but I found I Am the Night as an interesting way into thinking about vigilantism, right? And how we heroicize it, how they heroicized it. And so this leg of the work, as we're seeing in some of the prints on the walls and some of the paintings here, are really like my space to lean into and think about the subject matter. What we're seeing in the space is works that borrow the language of inkblot tests and Rorschachs as, you know, taking cues from horror and how what's in people's minds, like when you watch Jaws and you don't see the shark, is probably more scary than what I could illustrate. I found myself thinking about this as a foil for people to see and go into their own mind, imagining things that, you know, maybe what I'm trying to present on the surface might be different, but allows them space to move and to be and to form a strong connection with this history that they might not be that familiar with, especially after they read the location of where some of these things happen.
And maybe I can just take a moment to describe for our listeners what they're not seeing, right? So we're standing in this room, and there are these photographs or images from Soul Train imposed over drawings. Forgive me, we're not standing that close, even more impressive. Imposed over this shadow taken from one of these photographs that were given out or postcards as souvenirs at lynchings. Mm-hmm. And as we move around the room, as you mentioned, these Rorschach drawings, which at first looked abstract to me, but now as I'm staring at them, I'm seeing shapes and figures in them.
Yeah, you'll start seeing fragments of people, of legs, of horses, of hooves, very, very prominently, which became kind of an interesting rhythm that I don't know what to do with yet, is the prominence of the Afro and Soul Train, like in groups of dancers in Soul Train, and how that's echoed with like these bowler caps or the fedoras in the sea of lynch mobs, you know, that are present in these terrible occasions. So
it's a lot to take in, yeah. And there's I hope people can get out here to see it themselves. So as with everything else,
just a thought to kind of bring it all together, wrap it all up. This is really my hope is that this is an acknowledgement of centuries of angst and racialized terror, but also survival and innovation and family and an effort to carve out and create community and space even through adversement. And so that's what I'd really like to kind of linger with, is like, we have different American experiences. How are they connected? Where do we start seeing those threads? Where do we notice they were already there that we didn't even connect before? And how do we take this collective experience and create space for fresh empathy and action?
Places and spaces I've been.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you. This is wonderful. Thank you for coming.
Thank you all for being so patient, by the way. I really appreciate it.
I wasn't sure exactly how we were going to go through the space.
I wasn't sure either.
Sort of back and forth, but I'm hearing about the work in really new ways this time around, too. Yeah. So it's really great to sort of do a tour and sit with the work, like Blair is saying. Yeah.
Well, it's a privilege to be here with the artists behind an exhibit. How many people get that opportunity? So I appreciate it.
For sure.
The exhibit is Black on Black on Black on Black, now through December 10th at the Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The artists we've spoken with today are Nikita Thomas, Blair Ebony Smith, Stacy Robinson, and Patrick Earl Hammy, all on the faculty of the University of Illinois. Special thanks also to Julia Nucci Kelly of the Krannert Art Museum for coordinating our visit.
The 21st Show is produced by Aiden Choate, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Anaya Jones and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.